Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to the author of Going Public, A Guide for Social Scientists. The book was published this year by the University of Chicago Press. The authors are Arlene Stein and Jesse Daniels. I have the pleasure to have Jesse Daniels on the phone. Jesse, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Heath.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you on, to have read the book that is so of our scholarly moment in terms of its subject matter. Before we get to it, would you first introduce yourself and then maybe also briefly your co-author who's not with us today?
Sure, happy to. I'm Jesse Daniels. I'm a professor of sociology at Hunter College and at the Graduate Center of CUNY. And I'm happy to be co-authoring this book with Arlene Stein, who's a professor of sociology across the Hudson River at Rutgers University.
Now, the book is about a subject similar to having a podcast about new books, which is engaging a somewhat wider audience than we as academics and social scientists typically do. Before we get to how that happens, you characterize in the book an old model of scholarship, the scholar as expert. I wonder if you'd start us off by describing a little bit about how that old model worked.
Yeah, the old model of the scholar as expert was really just academics doing their job in the usual way, publishing in peer-reviewed journal articles, peer-reviewed journals with very few readers typically, sometimes books, and then having someone outside of academia stumble upon their work and declare them an expert worthy of speaking to the public. So that was sort of certainly the model that I was trained with in graduate school, and I believe Arlene was as well. And that sort of depended on us never rethinking what we do as academics in any sort of profound way. We just were hoping to sort of be discovered, if you will, by the outside world.
And this new approach, an approach that you certainly have taken up and others have, but it's not universal, involves some change of thinking about how we do what we do. You talk early in the book about the idea of code switching and using that mm-hmm. as a way to think about engaging a wider public audience. Would you talk about that idea of code switching and how it applies here to the scholar engaged with the world?
Sure. You know, the way that we're typically trained in that sort of expert model is that we're talking to other specialists, and that's the lingua franca of academia, talking to specialists who share our training, who share our vocabulary, who are helped by our jargon because it shortcuts longer conversations when we say things like post-structuralist, for example, that shortcuts body of literature, and other people who've had the same training know what we're talking about. But when we switch audiences or we seek to speak to somebody who's not had the same kind of training, and it actually could be in other disciplines within academia, but what we're really talking about are people outside of academia, we have to switch the language that we use. There's a practice from African-American communities talking about code switching all the time, sort of talking to white dominant audiences and in community conversations among other African-Americans. And this is sort of using that term to talk about the way that academics who wish to reach a broader audience switch their language and switch their conversation and switch their use of jargon to reach a broader academic audience. So, for example, when I'm writing on the Racism Review blog, I'm referencing, which is a blog that Joe Fagan and I started in 2007 to sort of bring academic research to a wider public audience. When I'm writing there, I'm definitely referencing scholarly research, but I'm also doing it in a kind of informal, a colloquial type of speech, and I'm not using as much jargon as if I were giving a professional presentation or writing a professional paper only for other academics. We've heard from people that use the blog that there are elementary school teachers, high school teachers, and students in their classes who are reading it. So it's thinking about a much wider audience who doesn't have the same kind of training. And what's the switch that you need to make to be able to reach that different kind of audience?
Now, often when people talk about the subject, they're talking about using social media, for example. But you also talk in the book about some ways in which our scholarship is translated in books. And you talk about three genres of general audience books, writing not a university press or a traditional academic book, but a different kind of book. I wonder if you could talk about those three different kinds of books and what makes them available to us as scholars.
Right. There are different kinds of different ways of approaching scholarship, and there are different ways of writing books. So the way that we typically have been taught to write books as academics is really, again, not that different from the journal model, where we're talking to other academics and peer reviewers, people who share our same background. But there are lots of different ways to go about writing books for general audiences. And one of the things that we talked about doing, we talk about in the book, is doing books for general audiences, such as idea books. These can be books that are just about a particular concept. You know, Eric Klinenberg has this wonderful book, Going Solo, which is an example of an idea book. And so those are ideas that synthesize a lot of different research that's out there. And I'm actually going to have to look up these other ones.
Yeah, but I think that idea of synthesis is so important for this idea, because it's synthesizing in a way that might not be familiar to us as academics, because the audience changes. And let me just sort of move on just a little bit, because the idea of audience seems to me to matter a lot here, and it matters a lot to the book that you guys have written. And you highlight Alondra Nelson's research and how she went about building her audience. I thought that section was really informative. I wonder if you could talk about Alondra Nelson, how she approached this, because it's something that seemed to matter a lot to her research, but then also to the audience for her research. Would you talk about that part of the book a little
bit?
Sure.
Yeah, one of the things that we did in this book is we actually interviewed academics about their experiences with going public. And one of my favorite interviews is with Alondra Nelson, who's a professor of sociology at Columbia University and also is dean of social sciences at Columbia, and in the fall will become the president of the Social Science Research Council. And Alondra has written two really marvelous books, one called Body and Soul, about the Black Panther movement, and the second one is called Social Life of DNA, about genetics and race. And one of the wonderful things that she revealed in that, because I had watched her social media presence around the first book and was really impressed, and because she really was involved with the community that cared the most about the Black Panther book project that she was doing, and that was former Black Panthers. So she spent a long time in that community, talking with people, going to really small community organizing meetings, and talking to people who had been former Panthers and had stories to tell. And she did that as a years-long process, partly as part of the research, but also as someone engaged in the issues that the Panthers cared about. And then when it came time for the book to come out, she sort of seamlessly moved her social media presence, both on Twitter and on Facebook, to promote the book. Now, she segmented that a little bit by creating a separate page on Facebook for the book. But on Twitter, she talked about the book and about it coming out and where she was going to be speaking. And I watched really small community organizations and small bookstores, request her to come speak at their venue, and she would do it. So it was a very kind of grassroots, bottom-up sort of way that she organically built this audience for the work that was to come. And one of the things that we highlight about that process that Alondra illustrates so beautifully is you don't want to be one of these academics who, works for years on a book and then suddenly get on social media just to talk about your book. Like, nobody wants to hear from you just about your book. It's like being a bore at a cocktail party where you just walk up to a group of people and, "Hi, I'm Jesse. Want to hear about my book?" Mm-hmm. It's like, really don't. So that was sort of wonderful in the way that Alondra did that. And then she had this other book, which is, you know, also, of course, really well written, thoroughly researched, but she knew instinctively that there was a really different audience for this book, that people who really cared about the Black Panthers were not necessarily going to care so much about DNA and genetics and the sort of intricacies of genomic medicine and the implications of that for race. And so she created different social media accounts for that book and went about a really different sort of process of thinking about who the audience was for that book. And she had a different kind of publisher for that book. For the first one, for the Panther book, it was a university press that she was very pleased with, but they didn't do a lot of publicity. For the second one, it was a trade press, and so they did a lot of the thinking through who the audience might be and reaching out to potential venues for her. So it was just a really interesting example, I thought, of different projects and the kinds of different audiences, thinking about audiences differently for those two different projects.
Yeah, and just the chance to talk about your work that you've spent so much time with anyone, let alone somebody whose life it affects, is so meaningful, which is to suggest that there's some real positive sides to this. There are also the negative sides, and towards the end of the book, you write about that. And these negative sides of this come in different forms, depending on the type of engagement we're talking about. But let's sort of maybe end our conversation talking a little bit about that, which is both kind of the form that that takes and the form it takes for different people, and also, you know, how to respond to it, maybe how you've responded to it and what you recommend.
Yeah, so we're living in interesting times, mm-hmm. and part of the sort of political landscape in which we live is that, you know, the big picture is that higher education is both underfunded and under attack, and part of that scheme of attacking higher ed is sort of pulling out individual academics for politically unpopular views and attacking them. So that's sort of the big picture. And within that, we have this emerging social media landscape that, frankly, universities and colleges don't exactly know what to do with. And so it creates this kind of in-between space where academics have this sort of space to say things on social media, and colleges and universities are not exactly quickly coming to their defense around things that they might say on social media. And we have sort of this growing right-wing presence that's ardently on the lookout for left-leaning academics that they might go after via social media. So that's kind of the big picture. And what that means is that individual academics can suddenly and quite sort of terrifyingly be caught up in a big, you know, for lack of a better word, a big scandal around social media. And that can be frightening for people who have never considered themselves public intellectuals or public scholars or public figures in any way. And part of the strategy of right-wing people who are attacking academics is to call for their jobs. Right, to say so-and-so said this thing on social media that we don't agree with and they should be fired. And that, too, is just stomach-turning, really, I think, in the way that it instills a kind of fear and queasiness in academics. And there aren't good responses yet that I've seen from colleges and universities. The good responses that I have seen have been from faculty governance bodies, whether those are unions, like we're fortunate to have here at CUNY, or things like faculty senates, or any kind of faculty body who sort of is coming at it from a perspective of faculty have the right to free speech and that sort of thing. The really bad reactions I've seen have been ones like happened at the University of Kansas, who after a professor said something, you know, incendiary after the shooting at Newtown, Connecticut at the elementary school against the NRA. People who are NRA advocates called for his firing. he was a full and tenured professor. He was suspended for a year, but got his job back. But in the wake of that, the University of Kansas drew up really draconian and drastic measures about faculty not speaking at all on social media unless they were doing so in a way that promoted the image of the University of Kansas in the way that, you know, the Board of Regents wanted them to promote it, you know. So unfortunately, colleges and universities' responses have been mostly concerned about branding and not about free speech or academic freedom.
Yeah, the book is just so interesting. And the title, again, is Going Public, A Guide for Social Scientists, published by University of Chicago Press. Jesse, along with Arlene Stein, are the books of this. And the illustrations, the great illustrations in the book, are by Corey Fields. Jesse, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.